Star Wars, Dark Force Rising by Timothy Zahn. Continued. Cassette number 6, side 2. No, I don't think there's any danger, Luke assured him. If you're worried, you can keep an eye on me through the X-Wing's sensors. He lowered his voice to a murmur. And while you're at it, I want you to start doing a complete sensor scan of the area. See if you can find any vegetation that seems to be distorted, like that twisted tree growing over the dark side cave on Dagobah, okay? R2 gave a somewhat bemused acknowledging beep. Good. See you later, Luke said, and dropped back to the ground. I'm ready, he told Kamauth. The other nodded. This way, he said, and strode off along a path leading downward. Luke hurried to catch up. It was, he knew, something of a long shot. Even if the spot he was looking for was within R2's sensor range, there was no guarantee that the droid would be able to distinguish healthy alien plants from unhealthy ones. But it was worth a try. Yoda, he had long suspected, had managed to stay hidden from the Emperor and Vader only because the dark side cave near his home had somehow shielded his own influence on the Force. For Kabaoth to have remained unnoticed, it followed that Jomark must also have a similar focus of dark side power somewhere. Unless, of course, he hadn't gone unnoticed. Perhaps the Emperor had known all about him, but had deliberately left him alone. Which would in turn imply... what? Luke didn't know, but it was something he had better find out. They had walked no more than 200 meters when the driver and vehicle Kabaoth had summoned arrived. A tall, lanky man on an old Soro-Sub recreational speeder bike, pulling an elaborate wheeled carriage behind it. Not much more than a converted farm cart, I'm afraid, Kabaoth said as he ushered Luke into the carriage and got in beside him. Most of the vehicle seemed to be made of wood, but the seats were comfortably padded. The people of Chainu built it for me when I first came to them. The driver got the vehicles turned around, no mean trick on the narrow path, and started downward. How long were you alone before that? Luke asked. Kabaoth shook his head. I don't know, he said. Time was not something I was really concerned with. I lived, I thought, I meditated. That was all. Do you remember when it was you first came here? Luke persisted. After the outbound flight mission, I mean. Slowly, Kabaoth turned to face him, his eyes icy. Your thoughts betray you, Jedi Skywalker, he said coldly. You seek reassurance that I was not a servant of the Emperor. Luke forced himself to meet that gaze. The master who instructed me told me that I was the last of the Jedi, he said. He wasn't counting Vader and the Emperor in that list. And you fear that I'm a dark Jedi, as they were. Are you? Kabaoth smiled, and to Luke's surprise actually chuckled. It was a strange sound coming out of that intense face. Come now, Jedi Skywalker, he said. Do you really believe that Jorus Kabaoth, would ever turn to the dark side? The smile faded. The Emperor didn't destroy me, Jedi Skywalker, for the simple reason that during most of his reign I was beyond his reach. And after I returned... He shook his head sharply. There is another, you know, another besides your sister. Not a Jedi, not yet. But I felt the ripples in the Force, rising and then falling. Yes, I know who you're talking about, Luke said. I've met her. Kabouth turned to him, his eyes glistening. "You've met her?" he breathed. "Well, I think I have," Luke amended. "I suppose it's possible there's someone else out there who..."
"What is her name?"
Luke frowned, searching Cabal's face and trying unsuccessfully to read his sense. There was something there he didn't like at all. "She called herself Mara Jade," he said. Kabouth leaned back into the seat cushions, eyes focused on nothing.
"Mara Jade,"
he repeated the name softly. "Tell me more about the outbound flight project," Luke said, determined not to get dragged off the topic. "You set off from Yaga Minor, remember? Searching for other life outside the galaxy. What happened to the ship and the other Jedi Masters who were with you?" Cabal's eyes took on a faraway look.
"They died, of course," he said, his voice distant. "All of them died. I alone survived to return."
He looked suddenly at Luke.
"It changed me, you know."
"I understand," Luke said quietly. So that was why Kabouth seemed so strange. Something had happened to him on that flight. "Tell me about it." For a long moment, Kabouth was silent. Luke waited, jostled by the bumps as the carriage wheels ran over the uneven ground.
"No," Kabouth said at last, shaking his head. "Not now. Perhaps later."
He nodded toward the front of the carriage.
"We are here."
Luke looked. Ahead he could see half a dozen small houses, with more becoming visible as the carriage cleared the cover of the trees. Probably 50 or so all told. Small, neat little cottages that seemed to combine natural building elements with selected bits of more modern technology. About 20 people could be seen moving about at various tasks. Most stopped what they were doing as the speeder bike and carriage appeared. The driver pulled to roughly the center of the village and stopped in front of a throne-like chair of polished wood, protected by a small dome-roofed pavilion.
"I had it brought down from the high castle," Kabouth explained, gesturing to the chair. "I suspect it was a symbol of authority to the beings who carved it."
"What's it used for now?" Luke asked. The elaborate throne seemed out of place somehow in such a casually rustic setting as this.
"It's from there that I usually give my justice to the people," Kabouth said, standing up and stepping out of the carriage. "But we will not be so formal today. Come."
The people were still standing motionless, watching them. Luke reached out with the Force as he stepped out beside Kabouth, trying to read their overall sense. It seemed expectant, perhaps a little surprised, definitely awed. There didn't seem to be any fear, but there was nothing like affection either. "How long have you been coming here?" he asked Kabouth.
"Less than a year," Kabouth said, setting off casually down the street. "They were slow to accept my wisdom, but eventually I persuaded them to do so."
The villagers were starting to return to their tasks now, but their eyes still followed the visitors. "What do you mean, persuaded them?" Luke asked.
"I showed them that it was in their best interests to listen to me."
Kabouth gestured to the cottage just ahead.
"Reach out your senses, Jedi Skywalker. Tell me about that house and its inhabitants."
It was instantly apparent what Kabouth was referring to. Even without focusing his attention on the place, Luke could feel the anger and hostility boiling out of it. There was a flicker of something like murderous intent,
Uh-oh, he said. Do you think we should? Of course we should, Cabal said. Come. He stepped up to the cottage and pushed open the door. Keeping his hand on his lightsaber, Luke followed. There were two men standing in the room, one holding a large knife toward the other, both frozen in place as they stared at the intruders. Put the knife down, Tarm, Cabal said sternly. Svan, you will likewise lay aside your weapon. Slowly, the man with the knife laid it on the floor. The other looked at Cabal, back at his now unarmed opponent.
I said, lay it aside, Cabal snapped.
The man cringed back, hastily pulled a small slug thrower from his pocket, and dropped it beside the knife.
Better, Cabal said, his voice calm, but with a hint of the fire still there. Now, explain yourselves.
The story came out in a rush from both men at once, a loud and confusing babble of charges and countercharges about some kind of business deal gone sour. Cabal listened silently, apparently having no trouble following the windstorm of fact and assumption and accusation. Luke waited beside him, wondering how he was ever going to untangle the whole thing. As near as he could understand it, both men seemed to have equally valid arguments. Finally, the men ran out of words.
Very well, Cabal said. The judgment of Cabal is that Svan will pay to Tarm the full wages agreed upon. He nodded at each man in turn. The judgment will be carried out immediately.
Luke looked at Cabal in surprise. That's all? He asked. Cabal turned a steely gaze on him.
You have something to say.
Luke glanced back at the two villagers, acutely aware that arguing the ruling in front of them might undermine whatever authority Cabal had built up here. I just thought that more of a compromise might be in order.
There is no compromise to be made, Cabal said firmly. Svan is at fault, and he will pay.
Yes, but... Luke caught the flicker of sense a half second before Svan dived for the slug thrower. With a single smooth motion, he had his lightsaber free of his belt and ignited. But Cabal was faster. Even as Luke's green-white blade snapped into existence, Cabal raised his hand, and from his fingertips flashed a sizzling volley of all-too-well-remembered blue lightning bolts. Svan took the blast full in the head and chest, snapping over backwards with a scream of agony. He slammed into the ground, screaming again as Cabal sent a second blast at him. The slug thrower flew from his hand, its metal surrounded for an instant by a blue-white coronal discharge. Cabal lowered his hand, and for a long moment, the only sound in the room was a soft whimpering from the man on the floor. Luke stared at him in horror, the smell of ozone wrenching at his stomach.
Cabal, you will address me as Master, the other cut him off quietly.
Luke took a deep breath, forcing calm into his mind and voice. Closing down his lightsaber, he returned it to his belt and went over to kneel beside the groaning man. He was obviously still hurting, but aside from some angry red burns on his chest and arms, he didn't seem to be seriously hurt. Laying his hand gently on the worst of the burns, Luke reached out with the force, doing what he could to alleviate the other's pain.
Jedi Skywalker, Cabal said from behind him. He is not permanently damaged. Come away.
Luke didn't move. He's in pain.
That is as it should be, Cabal said. He required a lesson,
and pain is the one teacher no one will ignore. Now, come away. For a moment, Luke considered disobeying. Svan's face and sense were in agony.
Or would you have preferred that Tarm lie dead now? Kabalth added.
Luke looked at the slug thrower lying on the floor, then at Tarm, standing stiffly, with wide eyes and face the color of dirty snow. There were other ways to stop him, Luke said, getting to his feet.
But none that he will remember longer.
Kabalth locked eyes with Luke.
Remember that, Jedi Skywalker. Remember it well. For if you allow your justice to be forgotten, you will be forced to repeat the same lessons again and again.
He held Luke's gaze a pair of heartbeats longer before turning back to the door.
We're finished here. Come.
The stars were blazing overhead as Luke eased open the low gate of the high castle and stepped out of the courtyard. R2 had clearly noticed his approach. As he closed the gate behind him, the droid turned on the X-Wing's landing lights, illuminating his path. Hi, R2, Luke said, walking to the short ladder and wearily pulling himself up into the cockpit. I just came out to see how you and the ship were doing. R2 beeped his assurance that everything was fine. Good, Luke said, flicking on the scopes and keying for a status check anyway. Any luck with the sensor scan I asked for? The reply this time was less optimistic. That bad, huh? Luke nodded heavily as the translation of R2's answer scrolled across the X-Wing's computer scope. Well, that's what happens when you get up into mountains. R2 grunted, a distinctly unenthusiastic sound, then warbled a question. I don't know, Luke told him. A few more days at least, maybe longer if he needs me to stay. He sighed. I don't know, R2. I mean, it's just never what I expect. I went to Dagobah expecting to find a great warrior, and I found Master Yoda. I came here expecting to find someone like Master Yoda, and instead I got Master Kabalth. R2 gave a slightly disparaging gurgle, and Luke had to smile at the translation. Yes. Well, don't forget that Master Yoda gave you a hard time that first evening, too, he reminded the droid, wincing a little himself at the memory. Yoda had also given Luke a hard time at that encounter. It had been a test of Luke's patience and of his treatment of strangers. Then Luke had flunked it, rather miserably. R2 warbled a point of distinction. No, you're right, Luke had to concede. Even while he was still testing us, Yoda never had the kind of hard edge that Kabalth does. He leaned back against his headrest, staring past the open canopy at the mountaintops and the distant stars beyond them. He was weary, wearier than he'd been probably since the height of that last climactic battle against the Emperor. It had been all he could do to come out here to check on R2. I don't know, R2. He hurt someone today. Hurt him a lot. And he pushed his way into an argument without being invited, and then forced an arbitrary judgment on the people involved, and... He waved a hand helplessly. I just can't see Ben or Master Yoda acting that way. But he's a Jedi, just like they were. So which example am I supposed to follow? The droid seemed to digest that. Then, almost reluctantly, he trailed again. That's the obvious question, Luke agreed. But why would a dark Jedi of Kabalth's power bother playing games like this? Why not just kill me and be done with it? R2 gave an electronic grunt,
a list of possible reasons scrolling across the screen. A rather lengthy list. Clearly the droid had put a lot of time and thought into the question.
I appreciate your concern, R2, Luke soothed him. But I really don't think he's a dark Jedi. He's erratic and moody, but he doesn't have the same sort of evil aura about him that I could sense in Vader and the Emperor.
He hesitated. This wasn't going to be easy to say.
I think it's more likely that Master Cabal is insane.
It was possibly the first time Luke had ever seen R2 actually startled speechless. For a minute, the only sound was the whispering of the mountain winds playing through the spindly trees surrounding the high castle. Luke stared at the stars and waited for R2 to find his voice. Eventually, the droid did.
No, I don't know for sure how something like that could happen, Luke admitted as the question appeared on his screen. But I've got an idea.
He reached up to lace his fingers behind his neck, the movement easing the pressure in his chest. The dull fatigue in his mind seemed to be matched by an equally dull ache in his muscles, the kind he sometimes got if he went through an overly strenuous workout. Dimly, he wondered if there was something in the air that the X-Wing's biosensors hadn't picked up on. You never knew, but right after Ben was cut down, back on the first Death Star, I found out that I could sometimes hear his voice in the back of my mind. By the time the Alliance was driven off Hoth, I could see him, too.
R2 twittered.
Yes, that's who I sometimes talk to on Dagobah, Luke confirmed. And then, right after the Battle of Endor, I was able to see not only Ben, but Yoda and my father, too. Though the other two never spoke, and I never saw them again. My guess is that there's some way for a dying Jedi to... Oh, I don't know. To somehow anchor himself to another Jedi who's close by.
R2 seemed to consider that, pointed out a possible flaw in the reasoning.
I didn't say it was the tightest theory in the galaxy, Luke growled at him, a glimmer of annoyance peeking through his fatigue. Maybe I'm way off the mark, but if I'm not, it's possible that the five other Jedi Masters from the outbound flight project wound up anchored to Master Cabal.
R2 whistled thoughtfully.
Right, Luke agreed ruefully. It didn't bother me any to have Ben around. In fact, I wish he had talked to me more often. But Master Cabal was a lot more powerful than I was. Maybe it was different with him.
R2 made a little moan, and another rather worried suggestion appeared on the screen.
I can't just leave him, R2. Luke shook his head tiredly. Not with him like this. Not when there's a chance I can help him.
He grimaced, hearing in the words a painful echo of the past. Darth Vader, too, had needed help, and Luke had similarly taken on the job of saving him from the dark side, and had nearly gotten himself killed in the process.
What am I doing? He wondered silently. I'm not a healer. Why do I keep trying to be one?
Luke! With an effort, Luke dragged his thoughts back to the present.
I've got to go, he said, levering himself out of the cockpit seat. Master Cabal's calling me.
He shut down the displays, but not before the translation of R2's worried jabbering scrolled across the computer display.
Relax, R2, Luke told him, leaning back over the open cockpit canopy to pat the droid reassuringly. I'll be all right. I'm a Jedi, remember? You just keep a good eye on things out here. Okay?
The droid trilled mournfully as Luke dropped down the ladder and onto the ground. He paused there, looking at the dark mansion, lit only by the backwash of the X-Wing's landing lights, wondering if maybe R2 was right about them getting out of here. Because the droid had a good point.
Luke's talents didn't lean toward the healing aspects of the Force. That much he was pretty sure of. Helping Cabalth was going to be a long, time-consuming process, with no guarantee of success at the end of the road. With a Grand Admiral in command of the Empire, political infighting in the New Republic, and the whole galaxy hanging in the balance, was this really the most efficient use of his time? He raised his eyes from the mansion to the dark shadows of the rim mountains surrounding the lake below. Snow-capped in places, barely visible in the faint light of Jomark's three tiny moons. They were reminiscent somehow of the Manorai Mountains south of the Imperial City on Coruscant. And with that memory came another one. Luke, standing on the Imperial Palace rooftop, gazing at those other mountains, sagely explaining to Threepio that a Jedi couldn't get so caught up in galactic matters that he was no longer concerned about individual people. The speech had sounded high and noble when he'd given it. This was his chance to prove that it hadn't been just words. Taking a deep breath, he headed back toward the gate. Chapter 15. Tangreen was our real crowning achievement, Senator Bel Iblis said, draining the last of his glass and raising it high above his head. Across the expensive but largely empty headquarters lounge, the bartender nodded in silent acknowledgement and busied himself with his drinks dispenser. We'd been sniping at the Imperials for probably 3 years at that point, Bel Iblis continued, hitting small bases and military supply shipments and generally making as much trouble for them as we could. But up till Tangreen, they weren't paying much attention to us. What happened at Tangreen? Han asked. We blasted a major ubiquitorate center into fine powder, Bel Iblis told him with obvious satisfaction, and then waltzed out right under the collective nose of the three star destroyers that were supposed to be guarding the place. I think that was when they finally woke up to the fact that we were more than just a minor irritant, that we were a group to be taken seriously. I'll bet they did, Anne agreed, shaking his head in admiration. Even getting within sight of one of Imperial Intelligence's ubiquitorate bases was a tricky job, let alone blasting it and getting out again. What did it cost you? Amazingly enough, we got all five warships out, Bel Iblis said. There was a fair amount of damage all around, of course, and one of them was completely out of commission for nearly 7 months. But it was worth it. I thought you said you had 6 dreadnoughts, Lando spoke up. We have 6 now, Bel Iblis nodded. At the time, we only had 5. Ah, Lando said, and lapsed back into silence. So after that was when you started moving your base around? Han asked. Bel Iblis eyed Lando a moment longer before turning back to Han. That was when mobility became a top priority, yes, he corrected, though we hadn't exactly been sitting still before that. This place is, what, our 13th location in 7 years, Sena? 14th, Sena said. That's if you count Womrick and the Metri asteroid bases. 14, then, Bel Iblis nodded. You probably noticed that every building here is built of bi-state memory plastic. Makes it relatively simple to fold everything up and toss it aboard the transports. He chuckled. Though that's been known to backfire on us. Once on Lelmra, we got hit by a violent thunderstorm, and the lightning strikes were hitting so close to us that the edge currents triggered the flip-flop on a couple of barracks buildings and a targeting center. Folded them up neat as a set of birthday presents, with nearly 50 people still inside. That was terrific fun, Sena put in dryly. No one was killed, fortunately, but it took us the better part of the night to cut them all free, with the storm still blazing on around us. Things finally quieted down just before daylight, Bel Iblis said, We were out of there by the next evening.
Ah.
The bartender had arrived with the next round of drinks. Twistlers, Del Iblis had called them. A blend of Corellian brandy with some unidentified but very tart fruit extract. Not the sort of drink Han would have expected to find in a military camp, but not bad either. The senator took two of the drinks off the tray and handed them across to Han and Sena. Took the other two off.
I'm still good, thanks, Lando said, before Bel Iblis could offer him one.
Han frowned across the table at his friend. Lando was sitting stiffly in his lounge chair, his face impassive, his glass still half full. His first glass, Han realized suddenly. Lando hadn't had a refill in the hour and a half since Bel Iblis had brought them here. He caught Lando's eye, raised his eyebrows fractionally. Lando looked back, his expression still stony, then dropped his gaze and took a small sip of his drink. It was about a month after Tangreen, Bel Iblis went on, that we first met Bork's Phalia. Han turned back to him, feeling a twitch of guilt. He'd gotten so wrapped up in Bel Iblis's storytelling that he'd completely forgotten why he and Lando had set off on this mission in the first place. Probably that was what had Lando glaring crushed ice in his direction.
Yeah, Phalia, he said. What's your deal with him?
Considerably less of a deal than he'd like, I assure you, Bel Iblis said. Phalia did us some favors during the height of the war years, and he seems to think we should be more grateful for them.
What sort of favors? Lando asked.
Small ones, Bel Iblis told him. Early on, he helped us set up a supply line through New Cove, and he whistled up some star cruisers once when the Imperials started nosing around the system at an awkward moment. He and some of the other Bothans also shifted various funds to us, which enabled us to buy equipment sooner than we otherwise would have. That sort of thing.
So how grateful are you? Lando persisted.
Bel Iblis smiled slightly.
Or, in other words, what exactly does Phalia want from me?
Lando didn't smile back.
That'll do for starters, he agreed.
Lando, Han said warningly. No, that's all right, Bel Iblis said, his own smile fading. Before I answer, though, I'd like you to tell me a little about the New Republic hierarchy. Mon Mothma's position in the new government, Phalia's relationship to her, that sort of thing.
Han shrugged. That's pretty much public record.
That's the official version, Bel Iblis said. I'm asking what things are really like.
Han glanced over at Lando.
I don't understand, he said.
Bel Iblis took a swallow of his Twistler.
Well then, let me be more direct, he said, studying the liquid in his glass. What's Mon Mothma really up to?
Han felt a trickle of anger in his throat.
Is that what Braelia told you, he demanded, that she's up to something?
Bel Iblis raised his eyes over the rim of his glass.
This has nothing to do with the Bothans, he said quietly. It's about Mon Mothma, period.
Han looked back at him, forcing down his confusion as he tried to collect his thoughts.
There were things he didn't like about Mon Mothma, a lot of things when you came right down to it. Starting with the way she kept running Leia off her feet doing diplomacy stuff, instead of letting her concentrate on her Jedi training. And there were other things, too, that drove him crazy. But when you came right down to it...
As far as I know, he told Bel Iblis evenly, the only thing she's trying to do is put together a new government.
With herself at its head.
Shouldn't she be?
A shadow of something seemed to cross Bel Iblis's face, and he dropped his eyes to his glass again.
I suppose it was inevitable, he murmured.
For a moment he was silent. Then he looked up again,
seeming to shake himself out of the mood. "So you'd say that you're becoming a republic in fact as well as in name?"
"I'd say that, yes," Anne nodded. "What does this have to do with Phalia?"
Belibles shrugged. "It's Phalia's belief that Mon Mothma wields altogether too much power," he said. "I presume you'd disagree with that assessment?"
Han hesitated.
"I don't know," he conceded. "But she sure isn't running the whole show like she did during the war."
"The war is still going on," Belibles reminded him.
"Yeah, well,
what does Phalia think ought to be done about it?" Lando spoke up.
Belibles's lip twitched.
"Oh, Phalia has some rather personal and highly unsurprising ideas about the reapportionment of power, but that's both ends for you. Give them a sniff of the soup pot, and they climb all over each other to be in charge of the ladle. Especially when they can claim to have been valued allies of the winning side," Lando said, "unlike others I could mention."
Sena stirred in her seat, but before she could say anything, Belibles waved a hand at her.
"You're wondering why I didn't join the Alliance," he said calmly. "Why I chose instead to run my own private war against the Empire."
"That's right," Lando said, matching his tone. "I am."
Belibles gave him a long, measuring look. "I could give you several reasons why I felt it was better for us to remain independent," he said at last. "Security, for one. There was a great deal of communication going on between various units of the Alliance, with a correspondingly large potential for interception of that information by the Empire. For a while, it seemed like every fifth rebel base was being lost to the Imperials through sheer sloppiness in security."
"We had some problems," Anne conceded, "but they've been pretty well fixed."
"Have they?" Belibles countered. "What about this information leak I understand you have right in the Imperial Palace?"
"Yeah, we know it's there," Anne said, feeling strangely like a kid who's been called on the carpet for not finishing his homework. "We've got people looking into it."
"They'd better do more than just look," Belibles warned. "If our analysis of Imperial communiques is correct, this leak has its own name, Delta Source, and is furthermore reporting personally to the Grand Admiral."
"Okay," Lando said. "Security. Let's hear some of the other reasons."
"He's off, Lando," Anne said, glaring across the table at his friend. "This isn't a trial, or..."
He broke off at a gesture from Belibles. "Thank you, Solo, but I'm quite capable of defending my own actions," the senator said. "And I'll be more than happy to do so when I feel the time is right for such a discussion."
He looked at Lando, then at his watch. "But right now I have other duties to attend to. It's getting late, and I know you really haven't had time to relax since landing. Irenis has had your baggage taken to a vacant officer's efficiency back toward the landing pad. It's small, I'm afraid, but I trust you'll find it comfortable enough."
He stood up. "Perhaps later over dinner we can continue this discussion."
Han looked at Lando. "Such convenient timing," the other's expression said. But he kept the thought to himself.
"Sounds fine," Han told Belibles for both of them.
"Good," Belibles smiled. "I'll need Sena with me, but we'll point you in the direction of your quarters on our way out. Unless you'd rather I assign you a guide."
"We can find it," Han assured him.
"All right. Someone will come to get you for dinner.
Until later, then."
They walked in silence for probably half the distance to their quarters before Lando finally spoke.
"You want to go ahead and get it over with?"
"Get what over with?" Han growled.
chewing me out for not bowing and scraping in front of your pal, the senator, Lando said. Do it and get it over with, because we have to talk.
Hen kept his eyes straight ahead.
You weren't just not bowing and scraping, pal, he bit out. I've seen Chewie in a bad mood be more polite than you were back there.
You're right, Lando acknowledged. You want to be mad a little longer, or are you ready to hear my reasons?
Oh, this should be interesting, Hen said sarcastically. You've got a good reason to be rude to a former Imperial senator, huh?
He's not telling us the truth, Hen, Lando said earnestly. Not the whole truth, anyway.
So? Hen said. Who says he has to tell strangers everything?
He brought us here, Lando countered. Why do that, and then lie to us about it?
Hen frowned sideways at his friend, and through his annoyance he saw, for the first time, the tension lines in Lando's face. Whatever Lando was reaching for here, he was serious about it.
Okay, he said a little more calmly. What did he lie about?
This camp, for starters, Lando said, gesturing toward the nearest building. The senator said they move around a lot. 14 sites in 7 years, remember? But this place has been here a lot longer than half a year.
Hen looked at the building as they passed it. At the smoothness of the edges where the memory plastic would fold up. At the signs of wear in the sub-foundation.
There are other things, too, Lando went on. That headquarters lounge back there. Did you notice all the decoration they had in that place? Probably a dozen sculptures scattered around on those corner ledges between the booths, plus a lot of light poles. And that doesn't even count all the stuff on the walls. There was a whole antique repeater display panel mounted over the main bar, a ship's chrono next to the exit.
I was there too, remember? Anne cut him off. What's your point?
My point is that this place isn't ready to pack up and ship off planet on 3 minutes' notice, Lando said quietly. Not anymore.
And you don't get this soft and comfortable if you're still in the business of launching major attacks against Imperial bases.
Maybe they decided to lie low for a while, Anne said.
This business of having to defend Bel Iblis was starting to feel uncomfortable.
Could be, Lando said. In that case, the question is, why? What else could he be holding his ships and troops back for?
Hen chewed at the inside of his cheek. He saw where Lando was going with this, all right.
You think he's made a deal with Felia?
That's the obvious answer, Lando agreed soberly. You heard how he talked about Mon Mothma, like he expected her to declare herself emperor any day now. Felia's influence?
Hen thought it over.
This book is continued on cassette number 7, side 1.